netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. Today, Mike Seymour is going to talk with co-director Sean Tan about the Oscar-nominated short film The Lost Thing. This is a film that took years to create. It's based on Tan's 2002 kids' book of the same name. It's a story about a young boy finding a strange creature on the beach, and he decides to find it a home. As you'll hear in the interview, this piece has a very stylized and painterly feel, and I think you'll find it, as I mentioned in the wrap-up of the last podcast, a very interesting change from some of the technical stuff we often talk about here to a more of a creative process of coming up with this look and the techniques to produce this real stylized painterly feel. So let's jump over now to Mike Seymour speaking with Sean Tan.
And John, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
So this is a film that obviously is terrific to be acknowledged by your peers in the Academy, but this is also a project that's taking a very long time to actually bring to the screen. When did you first start the project? It must be very satisfying to now have it at this point.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it first started the film in 2001, just with some preliminary discussion. So that's quite a long period from 2001 to 2010 when it was finally finished. Of course, prior to that, I'd been working on the story as a picture book, which was its original form. So for me, this whole story has spanned almost a 12-year period. So yeah, finishing it was quite a relief, especially given that it wasn't an untroubled production. I mean, one reason it took so long was because of various technical difficulties and getting people together and my own availability. And so to finally see it come together and then to actually be successful has been really gratifying.
So the film started as a book, and then I believe Passion Pictures approached you about making it into a film, and then, of course, you co-directed it. But but you're no stranger to digital filmmaking because, in fact, you've worked as a concept artist on several films.
Yeah, at least a couple. I worked as a concept artist on Horton Hears a Who with Blue Sky Studios and also the Pixar film WALL-E, just in the very early stages, contributing some drawings and paintings.
One of the things I like about this film so much, apart from the story, which is enchanting, is the sort of textural nature of it. And I guess that's somewhat related to the story, obviously, because it underlines the narrative. But this feels like Terry Gilliam's Brazil done in pastels. I mean, that's the only way I could describe it. That not painterly, but almost drawn look, how easy was it to get that? Because I just think it makes the film enchanting.
Yeah, well, that was a trick, really. And certainly that was the area I was most concerned about and the area with which I feel I have the most expertise because my background is as a painter. Generally, when I conceive of stories, I think of them as painted images and in that sense, not entirely realistic, but sort of sitting in that interesting space between an abstract figuration and something that's meant to be convincing and palpable. I guess the problem with the medium that we chose to work in, which is digital, is that the software kind of lends itself to a certain realism, you know, in the use of models and lighting, and we were constantly trying to sort of make it look less real or a little bit more almost cartoon-like, but still feel as though these are solid objects in space. And so a lot of attention went into texture, and all the surfaces on all the digital models involve hand-painted elements, and those were painted by myself and then worked into the models by Tom Bryant, who was our digital artist. And then, of course, with the final compositing, there was a lot of adjustments. So I think, yeah, the texturing and colouring of each shot was really intended to make every scene look like it was a painting. And I certainly thought of it in those terms, like each frame almost is meant to appear like a painting.
It seems to me that the the environment, if we just want to start there before we get into more specifics, could have been very ominous and very threatening. And the characters themselves, again, threatening. Now, of course, audio is doing a huge job here because, to quote a Pixar expression, you use all of the buffalo. In other words, you use everything in your toolkit to communicate the story. But if we leave audio out for a second, I feel it is the lighting and those textures that stop this world from becoming a threatening world. When I was watching it for the first time, I always felt sort of it was reassuringly non-aggressive, no matter how grotesque or interesting the characters were. Was that always the case, even in the early stages of the book?
Yeah, I think so. Actually, the story began in its original form as just a very light-hearted comical story, and the darker elements, such as the bureaucracy and the government departments and the idea of a somewhat self-repressive society, those all came into my concept of the story as I was working on it in the course of a year. So I guess it was kind of useful to begin with that very, very light approach, rather than if I'd started in the other direction, thinking, oh, this is a story about a very dark world and all this sort of thing. I think it's quite possible that I may not have been able to then introduce those comical elements. But in the first, few sketches, it was almost like a cartoon about a boy finding this creature, which has, tentacles and horns, and then sort of exaggerating all the buildings and the way people live. And in the process, it I was quite surprised because it did take on this kind of nightmarish element. But yeah, that was something that really came afterwards, almost as a way of balancing out the humour and giving the whole story some kind of gravity and some almost a social realism that was missing in some of those early drafts.
Because if I was to describe this to someone that obviously hadn't seen it, it doesn't sound like you'd be able to pull it off. Because if I can paraphrase some of your own comments that I know you've made on things like the DVD, the central character, the lost thing, is kind of a red. So you ended up with a very grey environment to contrast that. But it's an environment without trees, without a lot of, any really greenery or wildlife and stuff. So you're in a stark, and that would sound like a 1984 kind of grey world. And you have to have a contrast between that. Otherwise, when the lost thing finds the utopia, there's no visual contrast to play with. And yet, before we find that utopia, I'm still finding the world kind of enchanting. Do you sort of feel yourself that you like both worlds? Because obviously there is no real sense of disgust at the non-utopian world.
Yeah, definitely. I love both worlds equally. In fact, I find the human world, as we call it, more interesting, even though it's a much bleaker place, because it does have... It's in a state of tension, in a way, because you've got humans, which are naturally kind of an organic form, and they're living in a world that's very mechanical, where everything's angular and so on. But you'll notice, too, in the film that there's no strict, straight lines throughout the whole film. So even when we're in a very urban space and you've got rectilinear buildings and street signs, there's just the most subtle kind of wobble or kink in things, almost like there is a kind of natural erosion happening to this industrial world, or it's returning to nature in some way, even while people are constantly maintaining and fixing it up. And the lost thing itself, I think, is always the visual relief in every scene because of its tentacles. So you've got these oozing, kind of flexible, soft tentacles that kind of intrude into this very grey, very structured, very concrete universe. And the lost thing itself kind of represents some in-between point between the two worlds because it has this metal, sort of mechanical outer shell, but it's got some kind of strange pulsing life inside of it. And so I think that works. It kind of sustains your interest. Otherwise, it could be like a bit relentless and also just feel like a pretentious kind of caricature of post-industrial society all the way through. But of course, you have that relief at the end where you've got the utopia scene and then you sort of see the other side, which is complete wildness and colour. Before returning back to the real human world.
And even the parents, which are not particularly helpful from a plot point of view to our hero's plight, still come off as kind of sympathetically benign. And I noticed that there's lots of sort of slow and quite deliberate actions in the terms of the secondary animation. For example, I don't know, a character leans forward to put something inside the lost thing, and the glasses will slide forward. There'll be a little kind of motion, just soft, pushing them back. There's no sort of sudden or annoyance to anything.
No. Part of the idea of the story is that people aren't reacting aggressively. They're acting extremely passively towards the creature, and I guess the sense that that apathy is a form of aggression. Like, it's actually quite damaging, but there's no meanness in it. I didn't also want the world to appear as though it is a 1984 universe or something like Terry Gilliam's Brazil, where you've got this kind of oppressive authority that's kind of crushing individualistic hopes. It's more like the idea that closer to the real world, that if there is any problem in society, it's kind of a product of a general apathy from the public. In a democracy, we can complain about election results, but at the end of the day, it's people who are voting and so on.
It's interesting you bring that up, because that's a numbers issue, and numbers feature very prominently in the film In That Human World. I loved, for example, the flat door sign when he goes to his friend and the friend's approach to it. And I think you said that this was a world without, as we would know it, poetry. The only sort of literature is math, which, coming from a math background myself, seemed a perfectly reasonable thing.
yeah, the language of the universe. well, I mean, part of that came from the process of developing the original book, and I wanted to introduce an element of collage, because I was very interested in the idea of oil paintings that incorporated collage print material. And I was rummaging through stuff at my parents' house, and I came across some of my dad's old physics and chemistry textbooks, and these were really quite attractive, very nicely illustrated, and the text was extremely dry, as you can imagine, but when you read it and you cut out little sections, which I started doing, there is a kind of interesting poetry there, and it talks about logarithms and exponential functions and so on. And when I was sticking those next to my illustrations, I just found this infinitely amusing, just using these random captions against pictures that have nothing to do with them. But the byproduct of all that playing around was this idea that perhaps this is the only literature in the universe of the book, and I imagined my original picture book as actually coming from the world of the lost thing, but that the person who created the book had no previous knowledge of picture books, so had to make one by painting over the tops of other textbooks. And so that's where that idea came in. And, of course, it makes perfect sense in the universe, because it's such a dry world that's obsessed with basic functions. And also I was having a conversation with someone that I know, and asking what they read, and they said they don't read books. The only books they read are instruction manuals. And I think there are a lot of people who only read, useful books. And so I was quite interested in the idea of a world where there was only useful books.
There's a duality to some of your work that I think is really fascinating at an artistic level. Now, a good example of this is there's a style of narrative at a point in the film which looks to a first glance as if you're doing comic book panels, but they're not comic book panels. They're kind of your own derived version of that. And similarly, there's quite a lot of other artistic references that are like sort of derived from it. So you're simultaneously, by duality I mean this, you're simultaneously being incredibly original and quite referential to an artistic heritage.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, I don't sort of see the two as very different. Every sort of original idea is more or less based on something that's gone on before. It's not possible to have an idea that's not connected with other ones. So I guess instead of being in denial about that, I always try to emphasize my influences up front. So, for instance, I draw, at least in The Lost Thing, I drew quite a bit of inspiration from painters such as Edward Hopper and some Australian painters of the urban landscape such as John Brack and Geoffrey Smart. And in the original book, I sort of made this very clear by actually including elements of these artists' paintings in my backgrounds. So it was obvious to some readers in the know where my influences had come from.
But those, for those people that don't know, maybe especially some of those Australian artists, these aren't... Because I would have said, if you were going to quote, I mean, I hadn't spoken to you or whatever, I would have said your inferences, if you were going to quote an artist, would be something like Miro, because that's a more sort of direct line. But you're actually quoting more compositional reference with no kind of theatricality to them in the sense of what we're used to from the film.
I mean, I'm really attracted to paintings that have an implied theatricality, so... and a lot of my other paintings look like this. Like, I almost paint landscapes that are consciously empty, as if someone's about to walk into them but hasn't quite got there yet. And that's true with a lot of Geoffrey Smart paintings too, for instance. These will have these tiny little figures, and they're dwarfed by a somewhat incomprehensible industrial landscape or a big meaningless street sign. And I don't know, I just find these really attractive for some reason. They strike a chord. And in The Lost Thing, there are quite a lot of shots where the characters are quite small in the landscape, which I think is not so common for film, you know. If you look at it, there's not that many close-ups of characters' faces. And in the book, there's even less, you know. The main character's face never really exceeds a height of about 3 centimetres on the page. And it's almost like everybody's subsumed by the landscape, and there's a sense of all pervasive quietness about the place, which I find that also happens in a lot of surrealist paintings like Miro and Dali and Ernst and so on, is this idea of individuals who are sort of in a confusing landscape, and they're quite small and surrounded by this feeling of disquieting emptiness.
Yeah, I think some of the Miro operatic period stuff, the sort of less obvious like Miro stuff, just seemed to resonate for me for your work. But again, that would be me doing a literal kind of link to this kind of whimsy, where I think some of your structural links are probably more interesting and certainly warrant more time than we can afford to spend on them now. If I can swing back to some of the technical stuff that you touched on, because obviously that is, you know, you have to make the film. How comfortable were you in generating those textures before you started? Because you've done beautiful hand illustrated work, but that's quite different necessarily than getting, for example, distress into a painting that can be therefore scanned as a flat texture. Or is it? Maybe it's the same thing. I don't know.
It's quite similar. It's not too different. I guess I had the advantage that I was working quite closely with Tom, even though he was in Edinburgh and I was in either Perth or Melbourne for the duration of the project. And what I would do is I would do a sketch first of an element such as a desk or a creature or a person in the film. Tom would create a three-dimensional untextured model based on that. He would send that back to me, and what I would do is I would just lay in Photoshop these cut-out textures over the top of the models as multiplied layers, just to sort of get a sense of how they might look with the painted texture wrapped around them. Send that back to Tom, he would apply those textures, send it back to me, and then there'd be this constant backwards and forwards editing of each model. So it was kind of like we were both building and painting the model together. And after a while, our styles started to align, so there needed to be less briefing about particular objects. I could just supply a texture, and Tom kind of knew what needed to be done and had his own style of doing things, which I accepted as well. So in the end, it's still a bit of guesswork trying to figure out how a scene is going to look when it's finally rendered and textured, so that always made me a bit nervous. Especially working with the animation, all you're really seeing is grey wireframes. Occasionally we'll colour the Lost Thing red for working purposes, because we know that our eye is going to always be on this red thing on the screen. But when the environment is more colourful and there's different sources of lighting, it gets a little bit tricky. And I would do some pastel crayon sketches to try and help out, just to pre-visualise. in the end, everything worked out quite well, and that's largely due to Tom also coming in on the lighting and handling that side of things. So the fact that it was such a multitasked sort of film where it wasn't so departmentalised, a lot of people were doing multiple jobs, meant that it was actually quite, able to get a result that was what we really wanted.
I don't know if this is a question for Tom Bryan or for Leo Baker, your animator, but because this was like literally kind of in production for 3.5 years, did the technology shift at all? Was there a technological approach that changed during the production?
There was a little bit of a technological shift. I mean, you know, you're talking about the space of a decade, so naturally there is going to be that change. For me, it changed quite a bit because I started to use Photoshop a lot more in doing my pre-production sketches and being able to receive and send information. I remember when we first started the project, actually, the earliest animatics and animation tests were sent to me on a VHS cassette tape. So that gives you some idea of what we were dealing with. And the actual software, I think there were changes. There was a period where the film was in development in the UK, and that ran into a number of troubles, and it ended up stalling, and then it resumed here in Melbourne about 4 years ago, and we were using XSI and Nuke as the main software for the film.
Can I ask whether the film took on a traditional pipeline in the sense that you got everything to a point, then you moved everything to the next phase? For example, let's just take a random scene. Like, one of my favourites is, I think it's the unclassified character, the character that meets in the department of...
Ogden.
Thank you. And great character. You never see their face, but I love this ticker tape on the back. Well, on a character like that, is that character animated and all the other characters animated, and then it is textured and lit like everything else is textured and lit, and then it's all finally rendered? Or would a scene like that have got all the way through while maybe another one was way back? It was, how much was it sort of you'd complete everything before you moved on to the next step, and how much was it sort of bits and pieces?
That's interesting. It was very fragmented. For instance, the Utopia scene, which you would think would maybe be the last scene that we would tackle, was actually the first. And the reasons for that were that it was very difficult. We knew that there were, you know, a huge range of characters and backgrounds that we would have to build, and so it was kind of a test to see if we could handle that. And secondly, it's kind of a contained universe that runs for about 2 minutes. So if there was some kind of inconsistencies there or discrepancies in lighting effects, it didn't really matter too much because the logic of the world is that it's all a bit crazy anyway. Whereas with the rest of the film, there had to be this kind of consistency and continuity. Basically, we went through and we did our best to develop everything kind of at the same level gradually. Starting with an animatic and that kind of very clunky form of basic animation to try and figure out the length of scenes and so on. And then basically addressing different parts. But it was all pretty much backwards. We kind of started at the end and moved our way forward. So... and that was according largely to editorial questions that we had about some sections. So the first chapter of the film, if you can call it that, happens on a beach, and it's kind of quite critical because it's the first time that the main character encounters the creature and we're introduced to the whole situation. And we were unsure about certain kind of shots and so... and how much time that we actually had on that section. So we kind of left that until last and then fine-tuned it once we'd pretty much established the rest of the film. But, it was kind of according to who was doing what and how much production art was available, what textures were already done. So I suspect that a lot of films work this way. You sort of organise them according to what seems logical in terms of production, but not storytelling.
And your co-director, Andrew, he hadn't, I don't believe, had a lot of directing credits prior to this. Did you work on separate scenes, or did you work together on the same thing and there were different roles in terms of that co-directing? How did that work?
Andrew's role was sort of mostly active right at the beginning of the project and towards the end, and in between, he was kind of a almost like a supervising editor in the sense that I mean, I was essentially directing all the shots and details of the film. Andrew would have a look at that and approve sections and also indicate if there were any problems. Even though he's not a director as such, he's been involved with film production for quite a long time and is very experienced at it. So his advice was quite useful all the way through. He was present also with the initial storyboarding of the film, so we all convened in Melbourne and spent a couple of weeks, and then on another occasion we all got together in Perth and worked for another couple of weeks just refining the storyboard. And that was all about kind of agreeing on the direction of the film, the general philosophy, the approach in terms of, you know, are we going to have a lot of camera movement or very simple scenes. And the whole time with all of those meetings, our producer was present, Sophie, and she's actually kind of the uncredited third director. In fact, she probably had in between more input into each scene in terms of whether there's problems or not, or at least as much, if not more, as Andrew. And partly because she also is the person who had the fullest grasp of the whole production, including budget and what was possible.
And you, just for those that don't know, might maybe imagine that that this was like a necessarily inexperienced team, because obviously sometimes short films are, but this is far from it. Like people like Leo Baker, who worked on this with you as the animator, for example, has great film credits from work with Rising Sun and tons of stuff. And I guess when you've got a small team like that and you've only got sort of three or four people, I think your lighting and compositing, Stephen Evans, actually also similarly has a ton of credits for everything from Avatar to, I think he's on Tintin now. Would you, if you were doing a project like this again, would you advocate this idea of just a really small group of very good people, or would you advocate like that it'd be better to get a larger team and just get through the work, even if it meant not sort of handpicking the...
I don't know, you know, I can't really say, because I've only had the one experience, which was very good. My feeling is probably the former, that just having really experienced and also quite creative people that you trust aesthetically and in terms of their technical skills as well is probably the way to go. I think our production benefited greatly from having a really small team. I'm always a little wary of collaboration, partly because I feel a lot of things get lost in translation. You know, it's one thing to say, you know, this landscape should look a little bit post-apocalyptic, but everybody has a different understanding of what that means. And if you have a big team, it sort of means you have to devote a lot of time to having a discussion so that everybody agrees and understands stylistically what we're chasing. I think the ability to actually just work with that small team and over an extended period, so, you know, we could had time to make mistakes, was actually really, really good. And I can't imagine actually getting as effective a result from working with a large group. Certainly a much quicker result, like we could have done the whole film in less than a year if we had a team of animators and so on. But, I don't think it would have necessarily had that nuanced intelligence that you get from keeping everything intimate.
Because you have a certain amount of luxury on a short film. I understand that you're looking at long-form projects, like feature film projects. Would you have any gut feeling at this stage as how you'd like to approach something like that if you're directing an animated feature?
Not really sure, because, yeah, I tend to favour short stories, both in writing and in film, but I guess a feature film is really a series of short, very connected stories that all link up to create some kind of collective whole. I don't know. I mean, I've always kind of had this approach to things that I'll give it a shot. I mean, even with this film, I was a little bit hesitant about being involved with it at first because of my lack of experience. I thought, oh, well, I'll give it a shot, you know, and see if I can do it. And it actually worked out pretty well. So,
it worked out very well.
yeah, I'm confident that, you know, if given a challenge, I can figure out how to do it if I've got good people that I can work with and consult with.
And I guess the other thing that's unusual about this film from a sort of a normal animation pipeline is that because it came from a book and because you had such solid, very, very solid visuals to work from, you weren't doing the normal job of casting voice actors and then animating to them and having some of their performance influence the character. You were really getting a voice to come along with what was already pretty much established. Did you give that much thought, or was that just there was no other option?
There wasn't really any other option, but we also established quite early on that we would avoid lip-syncing, and as much as possible, I think there's only maybe 4 words that are actually lip-synced in the whole film.
The popcorn?
Yeah, where he says, but it's lost, and then his friend Pete says, cool. So that's about it. Partly that was a budget thing. It was also a stylistic choice because I wanted to create the impression that it was a world in which communication is not highly valued. And that kind of works quite effectively. I mean, there was even a situation where the parents have something to say, and in the book the mum says something and the dad says something. In the final film, we sort of were just working on it, and we realised, oh gosh, we can't actually lip sync them. What are we going to do? So I rewrote it so that it was the boy was projecting what the mum and dad were thinking, and in a way that was even more effective because it's almost like it wasn't even necessary for them to open their mouths. It was that level of a kind of automated response that they just have to give him a look, and he interprets that for the audience. So. It's possible that if we had the facility to do lip syncing and we already had pre-recorded voices, that we would have just automatically done that without thinking. And sometimes these kind of limitations can be really useful in making you think about resourceful ways of telling the story and improving it.
Well, look, I should finish up by asking a couple of obvious questions, which was, did you have any inkling that you were going to be nominated? Was it because it had gone so well at previous festivals, and was it a surprise?
It was a surprise, you know, because I personally just had real doubts that it would get into that final shortlist. It had been on 2 previous shortlists, so it qualified as one of 33 films, and then it was one of 10. And then there was that final announcement, and I was really feeling, you know, oh, this could go either way, and awards are a bit of a lottery. You can't sort of assume that you're in, even if you think that your film is very good. But we had one at the Annecy International Animation Festival in France, and apparently that's a very good sign. Generally, if films are able to win that award, then they've got a very good shot at being Oscar nominated, and that was our first real success with the film, which came quite early, and it was something of a relief because we just missed out on acceptance into 2 pretty big festivals after we'd finished the film and started submitting it. So there was kind of like this really disappointed feeling amongst the crew, and then we won at Annecy, and there was a sudden kind of elevation, like, oh wow, actually our film is not bad after all. And we've won a few awards since then, so that's been really encouraging. The Oscar nomination, it was, you know, I'm still trying to get my head around it, especially looking at the standard of the other films out there. I mean, the standard of short animation seems to have progressed in leaps and bounds in the past 10 years, so it's quite competitive.
One of your co-nominees for Day and Night is, of course, a Pixar film, which, you know, you said you worked on the early stages of WALL-E. Did you know Teddy, or do you know Teddy, the director?
No, I know of his work, but not... I don't know anybody at Pixar really very personally because I was working quite remotely as just a concept artist.
Because you were doing that sort of work that we often see in the art of books, don't you? Like where it's like,
yeah, that's right. In fact, I do have some a few pieces in the art of WALL-E, and yeah, it's pretty much the same as most of my other jobs as a freelance illustrator, you know, I have a brief. I send in sketches. I refine those sketches. I get my check. That's it. I haven't actually had the opportunity of meeting anybody from Pixar, and I'm hoping I might have at least a chance on this trip.
Yeah, I would expect so. Have you seen the other nominated films? And
Not all of them, but I've seen I've seen Day and Night and The Gruffalo and Madagascar, the French film, which is probably my favourite of the bunch. Although it's kind of a little experimental. All of them could win, I think.
It is a wonderful medium because you're getting an opportunity to produce something that doesn't have to be perhaps quite so literal or narratively linear as obviously
in
feature films tend to be. So you tend to get some pretty interesting entries, and it's a very rewarding creative category to be nominated in because this really is not doing it by the numbers. This is such a personal work for you. So congratulations.
Yeah. That's a really good observation. I mean, even if I wasn't involved in animation, the short animation section of the Oscars would still probably be the most interesting for me because it's pretty random, and it also does represent some opportunity for people who are somewhat outside of the system to, you know, get an Oscar nomination.
It's not what we'd describe as a funded campaign race.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
But that being said, I think that it's incredibly healthy, and it's and wonderful to see the kind of quality of work that's being submitted. And in fact, as you pointed out, from so many parts of the world, which is also nice because
That's right.
The Academy.
Yeah, so I think it's two American films, one British, one French, and one Australian. So that's quite good.
Well, look, good luck on the night. They honestly say that the honours are being nominated, though in my experience from talking to people that have been nominated and won, you're more likely to get work if you don't win. Everyone then assumes you're hungry for the work, and the phone rings more often.
Right, that's interesting.
And if you do decide to go into features, we'll enjoy following your progress. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. Really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks. Really enjoyed it.
Well, thanks, Mike and Sean. Well, that'll do it for this FX podcast. For my partners, John Montgomery and Mike Seymour, this is Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.